It went down in history as the largest collection of statues of women ever assembled together. The Smithsonian's effort to feature 120 contemporary women scientists during Women's History Month on the National Mall. We explore the life and work of one of those women in STEM, empowering innovation here in Wisconsin on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. UW-Madison Professor Anna Scope is at the intersection of genetics and art, her lab focusing on mitosis, how cells divide, which she sees as absolute artistry. How does science and art come together for you? How do you create a STEM culture? How do you create a STEAM culture in education? 800-642-1234. Anna Scope, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
How did it feel for you to be one of these 120 American women scientists who had a statue there on the National Mall?
Well, it's quite intimidating and thrilling at the same time to be 3D printed and out there as a sculpture. But I'm quite honored, and it's been remarkable to meet so many amazing other women scientists doing unbelievably awesome stuff. So it has been very cool to be part of this program.
I would imagine you met women through this program that you had never known, women who had never been on your radar before.
Yeah, no, there's lots of women I've never met before. One of the coolest ones, I kind of had heard of her, but I met this one woman who actually has a galaxy named after her. So I thought that was kind of awesome. And, you know, there's very cool people that I met through this, and just people overcoming boundaries and changing the way and changing the view of science, and that women can do just about everything and that they want.
What was that process of having your likeness created for the project? I mean, just a little bit of science-y here on this 3D printing. What did it entail?
It kind of looked like I walked into a booth. It kind of it's like a bigger suntan booth or something. and there were a lot of lights up around the edge. And they had actually almost like a Project Runway kind of salon next to this. It was kind of fun, different kind of thing that I normally experience. And then we had, you know, we had our hair and makeup done, and we went in this booth, and then a bunch of lights went off, and this, it scanned our body in three dimensions. And it was very intimidating because there's a lot, nothing is hidden in this capture of ourselves. And we didn't really see the three-dimensional thing until it was printed. You know, we saw the photos of how the process, but it was very cool. You know, walked into a booth within seconds, you know, and then outcomes after several months of printing all of these things, outcomes a sculpture. So that was kind of cool.
I'm going to pick up on that word intimidating, because for some students, some people, science and math are very intimidating. How do you approach that? How do you lessen that stress?
I think that a lot of students think that, there's all the classes that they took in high school, they realize they have to memorize everything and do all that stuff. But really, that's not what science is about. We know things, but we're problem solvers, which is super fun. I mean, lots of, doctors, any job that you have are problem solvers. And so science can be intimidating because I think people think about all these other things and how those exams might have been to memorize things. But I think the way science is being taught now is changing, because we're doing this project-based learning in the classroom. And I think that's where the fun is. And that's what I like about science, because I study how cells divide, which is important. You know, when it goes wrong, that's what happens in cancer. And so I want to figure that out and to be a problem solver. In that sense, it's fun, and I can come up with my new ideas and do that. And I think that's where, you know, science can be intimidating, because you realize you have to understand the breadth of knowledge of science. Mm-hmm. But when you get down to it, you understand your problem, and then you start to ask questions. And that's where it becomes fun. It can be intimidating because there's a lot of, you know, a lot of data and knowledge that you have to read up on. And I don't know everything either, but I'm able to ask questions and attempt to answer them in the laboratory.
And asking questions is a big part of how you teach, that participation, I understand, that group discussion, hugely important in your classes. And lecturing from the front of the class is is much of lesser importance. Why is that?
I decided to flip the classroom because I realized one of my favorite courses in my own undergrad was a plant physiology class where the class he barely lectured and we did the problem solve. So he gave us a problem: aphids bite plants, solve it in any way you could solve it. And I love that because that's how science actually is. And I realized when I became a faculty member, I wanted to kind of recreate that experience of, you know, I don't come to my laboratory and fill out a bubble sheet, right? I come to ask questions and try to answer them doing genetics and cell biology. And so I wanted to kind of create that in the classroom so that students experience the fun and excitement that I do. And I do that by teaching them how to communicate science visually and orally and verbally. And so students realize I give them their own project to work on, and they have to kind of come up with an idea that could potentially be a grant proposal. And they actually love being able to get in there and realize, oh my gosh, there are a lot of scientists that are working haven't even asked that question that they're interested in. I said, well, that's why you belong in science, you know. And I think that's the excitement that I want students to come away from my class, to realize that science is fun and that everyone's diverse background is very important in answering questions and problems in science. And, you know, we all want to help people just like medical doctors do. We do this because we want to help, right?
We're talking
and understand things.
I'm going to just reintroduce you here, talking with Anna Scope, who's a UW-Madison geneticist and artist, explaining her approach to teaching in the classroom and promoting STEM. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Anna, another thing that I found really interesting about your approach to teaching is that how you assign grades. You give grades through this growth mindset approach. Can you explain how you, the system behind how you award letter grades?
Yeah, I realized that a lot of students, and particularly women underrepresented students, there's often anxiety in the classroom. And it dawned on me that, you know, in the end, grades don't matter. It's what you get out of that course. So why not flip this idea of, instead of students working up towards 100 points, and most people know how to do all the math about losing points out of 100, why not give them all the points on the first day and everyone gets an A, and the goal is to try to maintain all those points. But I give them about 800 points because I'm also dyslexic, so hard to do a quick math out of 800 points, is that you don't really know how many points that you've lost. And so I kind of do that. What happens is there are lots of students on the first day, is I've never felt more confident on a first day of class than I did in yours. And I think that's why I use this unique strategy, is I want them to feel welcome and having the ability to succeed. Right. The point is not to tear people down. It's to build people up. And I think that growth mindset theory that is based on helps students understand that their point of view and what they bring to the table is important. It also levels the playing field because a lot of students have biases about where they are in the classroom. Is students that are C students, if they go into a class, they always will maintain the C. But if you give them this A, they can actually hit that A. It actually works to that student's benefit. But the A students, they'll just assume that they're always going to get an A by the end. But that might not be the case, you know. But I want to change that bias that students have coming into a science classroom and give them and make it a positive experience instead of a negative one, right? And so if you lose a lot of points at the beginning of the semester, you still actually have an A, where it's the opposite. If you lost a lot of points at the beginning, it's hard to build that back up. And so, yeah, the grading scheme is very simple and can work with any classroom. And, you know, I highly recommend it. And lots of educators that have seen me talk about this were kind of amazed by it because it's very simple. But it changes students' ability to succeed in the classroom. And students will always tell me in class, it's confusing because it's different than other classes. Mm-hmm. But then they end up loving it because they don't have that anxiety over these numbers and grades, which I don't want them to feel that way.
Well, they walk into class, as you said, being on a high point, not a low point, as to what they have to do to crawl their way up or claw their way up, so to speak, to get that grade. They really start in a positive mindset.
That's right. It works great. And it's very simple. So
let's spend just a moment here on dyslexia and being a visual learner. How has that shaped how you relate to students, how you facilitate learning?
Well, I think for me is on my first day of class, I tell students I have dyslexia. I have a physical disability. You know, I have a genetic disease that I suffer from, chronic pain. And I think if you tell your students who you are on the first day, I think it allows them to see you in a different light, that you're actually a real person behind there and you're not this untouchable scientist. And I think students ask me, it's like, I never met a scientist who admitted in public that they were dyslexic. And I said, you know, and my parents told me, you know, that's like Einstein was dyslexic. Lots of famous scientists actually were. And you realize that, you know, it's, you know, dyslexia is a gift. I struggled with a lot of tests myself. And I tell students that, you know, I'm honest. I mean, I'm here because I had great mentors and teachers that realized I had a gift in science. And how I learn, you know, I have to do things in different ways that other faculty do, but I do it. But I think there's a lot of students out there very similar to me. And by the end of my class, when students say that, they're like, I'm dyslexic too. And I just never heard of other professors say this before. And I think sharing your story has a lot of power in the classroom. And I think people don't do it enough. But the first day of class for me is the most critical day for that reason, because if you don't share who you are, how are those students going to relate to you or understand where you're coming from? And I think the same thing is I get to know the students on those same levels. You know, there's a personal connection there because I understand where they're struggling too. And I've been there, you know, I've been there through, you know, all of those things of lots of failures to get to lots of successes.
I'm reminded of one of your mentors who you put up in a presentation who told you that he got a D in math but invented a microscope. And, you know, I'm just thinking of that John White quote and the power of mentorship and being transparent about who you are.
Yeah, that was, you know, John White, who actually is the person who invented the laser scanning confocal microscope that we use in our lab, turned to me one day after I failed one of my prelims in graduate school for when I was getting my PhD. And that one statement was so transformative to me. And I looked at him, I was like, seriously, you invented this microscope, but you got this bad grade? I think that was the first time in my life I heard someone that famous kind of just turn to me and say, you know, classes, you know, that class didn't matter. And I was able to do this remarkable thing. And I am in science just because of that statement. I think I was in a low point in my career. I had enough failures in the classroom and realizing maybe I don't belong in science. But he said just that one statement turned to me, changed my life, course of my life forever.
UW-Madison genetics professor Anna Scope explaining her work to advance STEM, her approach to science and teaching. Are there collaborations between scientists and artists that have been meaningful to you? How so? Are you a scientist with an artistic streak? How do you explore your varied interests? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Anna Scope here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with UW-Madison genetics professor Anna Scope, who champions diversity and inclusion in STEM, uses aspects of her life story that we're hearing about to help make science more accessible, more welcoming, enlarging the tent, so to speak, in academia. Who was your role model in science? Did you know you'd be a scientist, or did someone encourage you to keep trying, keep at it when you thought you couldn't excel in math or another discipline? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Anna Scope with us for about 9 more minutes. Anna, let's talk a little bit about your passion for cell mitosis, and you call it nature painting itself. What do you see?
Well, when I first saw the process of mitosis, so from interphase, metaphase, anaphase, and then cytokinesis, is that coming from a background of artist, I was completely gobsmacked at how beautiful this process was. And then when I started to ask about it, is that there's a lot known, but there's still a lot we don't know about the process. And I think coming from a family of artists and seeing something so beautiful, and to be able then to ask the question, how does that work, right? And so I really appreciate the beauty in science. If it wasn't beautiful, probably I wouldn't study it. And partly for that reason. And I realized why later in life, why I really liked it, because my favorite artist is Moreau. And Moreau, Spanish artist, is if you look at some of his paintings, they look like cells. You can see nuclei and mitotic spindles in his paintings. And I just realized that how much art has influenced my choice in science, and partly because it's a beautiful process and very simple one.
You were very much influenced also by your late father. Could you tell us about what he did for you in art?
Well, my dad was a pupil of Mestrovic, who's a famous Croatian artist who studied with Rodin. And so my dad had an art school at our house, and he brought students from all over the world with a very eclectic background growing up. My mom was a ceramicist, an art high school art teacher, and my entire family are artists. And here I am as a scientist. And I think what I realized growing up in this family, if you know anything about genetics, you might assume that I inherited the recessive gene for science. But in fact, what was actually happening there is we all inherited an immense amount of creativity. And I realized, you know, my dad had such an influence on how I think, you know, thinking outside of the box, doing something different. And I think art, having that sensitivity and knowledge about art and everything, it influences the way I do science, you know, and that's, you know, and I was welcomed into my science community because of my creativity and my background. And I think that's a great thing. And I think we need to elevate those differences in our life. And my dad was just very instrumental in being there and showing me that, you know, like Da Vinci, that was a, you know, these are scientists who are also artists back then. And I think as, you know, as time went on, the way we teach our education system, we're getting away from the fact that art is not valued in science, when in fact it really is. And in particularly in the case of communicating science, now there's this whole community of science artists online, and the need to communicate science clearly and effectively for the public, to, as people know now, is very, very important.
Let's bring on a caller now. Patricia is joining us from Madison. Hi, Patricia. What is your story? And you're on with Anna Scope.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. It's an interesting and long story. I also had dyslexia as a kid. It's called spatial dyslexia. I believe the airplane would fit in my room. I also am lefty, so when I started writing, learning how to write, I would write from right to left, like Leonardo da Vinci. So I had a lot of work. I struggled with math for years, and then when I got to ninth grade, I had this amazing teacher that was in that school for 1 year. I don't know where he came from, but the way of teaching was different. Something clicked, and now I am... I have a PhD. I got a Fulbright scholarship to come to the U.S. to do my PhD. And I mean, you wouldn't think that when I was a kid. I struggled so much through school. And now I'm a scientist. I love science.
And what is your area of science?
I have a PhD in forestry.
Oh, wonderful. Anna, what do you hear with Patricia's story?
Well, sounds similar to me, Patricia. This is awesome to hear, is that there are teachers that, you know, get you, right? And I think they inspire you to take those chances. And I think that's a wonderful story, similar to mine. I said, great. I'm glad that you're able to stay in science and be excited about all that science has to offer, and that you are welcome in this community. So that's wonderful to hear, and glad that you had a wonderful teacher, because there's amazing teachers everywhere.
There are certainly amazing teachers everywhere. You know, I was really struck by your trajectory in being rejected as a grad student in 1994, now being in 2018 a full professor at UW-Madison. And I wonder how you reflect on that trajectory and that power of persistence.
I just think that, so I was rejected from the department in which I'm a full professor. So I didn't get into the department, but I got into another department on campus. So not completely fully rejected from the UW. But I find it just ironic that sometimes I sit there on the committees understanding that at the time, the GRE, the graduate exam to get into school was there was a lot of weight put on that exam. And I'm a perfect example, someone with dyslexia, where those tests were excluding me from a lot of places. And that's how people quantify people's able to success across, you know, when you apply for a program. And I knew at that time that, you know, that there's no way that is a description of my ability in science. Fortunately for me, there were people that knew I had to have mentors talk to other mentors at schools to tell, yeah, Anna's pretty terrific in the laboratory. She's just not a good test taker. And I have test anxiety, and I always had. And, the standardized tests were in no reflection of who I was as a scientist. And maybe many of you people know and listening is that a lot of schools have gotten rid of the GRE, which is terrific because it gets rid of that. But I realize some schools are realizing they do need some of these numbers as well to assess students. But I think there's more to people than these standardized tests. And I think it's really important to look at students holistically, and that the when you write evaluation letters, these are really, really important for students to move through their career path, and students to understand that those letters are really important, because these test scores don't evaluate you as a person and your work ability and all these kinds of things.
Anna, thank you for joining us.
Yep, thank you so much for having me.
Anna Scope, professor of genetics at UW-Madison, here on the Ideas Network.